Okay, so you're ready to deep dive with us today. We're going to tackle some pretty complex legal concepts. But don't worry, we're going to make sure it all makes sense. No one's grounding in case law on our watch.
Definitely.
Especially when we're talking about how, like, your individual constitutional rights, like, go head to head with actions taken by the government. We see that tension a lot, and today's case is a perfect example. So we're looking at a fascinating decision out of the New York Appellate Division, Third Department, People v. Anonymous from 2025. In this case, it really digs deep into that intersection of the right to counsel and this whole idea of when different parts of the government
Right.
agencies can be seen as like acting on behalf of each other. And get this, all of this is happening within the world of mental health and child welfare. So sensitive stuff.
Absolutely. People v. Anonymous. It's a case that really gets you thinking about how our legal system tries to walk that tightrope between protecting your fundamental rights and, the state's responsibility to keep everyone safe, right? To conduct investigations and all that. And in this specific case, we're dealing with a defendant with a history of, well, some pretty significant mental health challenges. And tragically, she caused the death of one of her children and attempted to harm another.
Awful.
Yeah. It's an awful situation. And after this horrible event, she ended up making some incriminating statements to Child Protective Services caseworkers. So you can imagine those statements became like a key battleground in the legal proceedings that followed.
They sure did. So our mission, our deep dive mission today, we're going to break down how the court decided whether those statements, the ones made to CPS, could actually be used against the defendant in her criminal trial.
Right.
And the really big question, the one we want to really focus on for you is, were those CPS caseworkers? Were they basically acting as agents of law enforcement when they got those statements? That's the crux of it.
It really is.
So let's unpack this whole thing. Let's go back to the beginning. What led up to this tragedy and then this huge legal fight?
Yeah, so the timeline is like super important to understanding the court's thinking here. Okay, so go back to September 2001. The defendant was diagnosed with a psychotic disorder. And this diagnosis, it kind of fueled this deep fear she had that her husband was mixed up in some sort of cult and that he planned to harm their two young sons. And sadly, this wasn't just like a one-time thing. She was actually hospitalized, not once, but twice because of her mental health struggles. And she was prescribed medication to manage her condition. But, and this is a really important detail about it, she would sometimes stop taking that medication because of, the side effects, which, can be pretty rough.
That's really tough. So this brings us to April 15th, 2002, just a devastating day. Can you tell us what happened?
So on that day, the defendant attempted to drown her 5-year-old son, Peter. And tragically, she was successful in drowning her 4-year-old son, Luke. It's just heartbreaking. And understandably, she was arrested after these events. And it's after her arrest that those crucial statements to the CPS caseworkers were made. Those post-arrest statements are at the heart of this legal battle. So definitely pay attention to that part.
So we have this horrific tragedy, then the arrest, and then these pivotal statements made to CPS. So how did those statements actually factor into the trial?
Okay, so at the trial, the defendant's lawyers were planning to use an insanity defense. Their goal was to show that because of her mental state at the time of the tragedy, she couldn't have formed the criminal intent necessary, for those crimes. But the prosecution, they wanted to counter that defense. And that's where the statements to the CPS caseworkers come in. They use those statements to try and argue against the defendant's claim of insanity, suggesting that her statements, they actually showed a level of awareness and understanding that would contradict that whole insanity defense. So yeah, those statements were pretty central to the prosecution's case.
They really were. And there was a procedural aspect to all this too, right? Something about how the prosecution wanted to use those statements that we should be aware of.
You got it. This is a super important point. The trial court allowed those statements into evidence, even though the prosecution hadn't given proper notice under New York's criminal procedure law, Section 710.3. This law is all about fairness. It's to make sure the defense isn't ambushed by evidence at trial. It requires the prosecution to give advance notice if they're going to use certain types of statements the defendant made.
Makes sense.
And the prosecution didn't do that here. This misstep was one of the reasons why the defense appealed the case later on. So it's not just what was said, but also about whether the proper legal steps were followed.
Okay, got it.
Right.
So the trial court let in those statements. The defendant was convicted, but then, as we said, the appellate division stepped in and reversed that conviction. So what were the big legal questions that made the appeals court overturn that decision?
Well, the appellate division's reversal really boiled down to two major legal questions. The first, and probably the most crucial, was whether those statements made to the CPS caseworkers were they obtained in violation of her Sixth Amendment right to counsel. You know, the Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to an attorney in criminal cases, right? But it's after formal charges are filed, so after the arraignment.
Right, right.
The second question, which is closely tied to the first, was this. Were the CPS caseworkers acting as agents of the police when they were getting those statements? If they were, then the Sixth Amendment protections, they would definitely apply.
So it all comes down to this idea of an agency relationship. How did the court figure out whether CPS was acting as an agent of the police in this case? Did they have like a test or something?
Yeah, they use a pretty standard four-factor test. It's commonly used to figure out if an agency relationship existed. And we can break down those factors. The first one is the connection between the investigations that were done by both CPS and the police. And in this case, the court noticed a pretty high level of cooperation going on between the two. They were operating under this thing called a multidisciplinary team framework.
Multidisciplinary team. What exactly does that mean and why should we care?
So a multidisciplinary team, it basically means you've got professionals from different agencies like law enforcement, CPS, all working together, sharing information about the case. Now, on the one hand, these teams can be really helpful. They can help coordinate responses and protect kids. But this case shows us there's a potential downside when we're talking about protecting constitutional rights. That close collaboration is a big part of what the court considered. The second factor is police instigation. Did the police initiate or direct the interview in some way? And the evidence suggested that the interview by those CPS workers, it was actually directed by the police. Law enforcement basically asked CPS to do that interview.
So the police weren't just like passively receiving information. They were the ones calling the shots.
Exactly. And then factor number three is police supervision. Were the police overseeing what CPS was doing during this whole process? And the court found that, yeah, law enforcement was overseeing the CPS caseworkers' actions. Again, this suggests a tight working relationship and a certain amount of control by the police.
Got it.
And the final factor, number four. This one's about the police objective. What was the goal? And the court decided that the main purpose of that CPS interview, it was to help build the criminal case against the defendant. It wasn't just about protecting the kids at that point. It was about gathering information for a prosecution.
Okay. So they had all these factors to consider the connection between investigations, police instigation, supervision, and objective. What was the appellate division's final conclusion about that agency relationship?
After looking at all four factors, the court said, yep, there was an agency relationship between CPS and the police here, and the multidisciplinary team set up. That close collaboration and information sharing, those were big factors in their decision. Now remember, the defendant had already been arraigned. That's when formal charges are officially filed in court, and that's also when the Sixth Amendment right to an attorney kicks in.
Right.
So her Sixth Amendment right to counsel had attached. And once that right is in place, if you're going to waive that right, especially during questioning, you got to have your lawyer there.
Makes sense.
But in this case, the defendant talked to CPS without her lawyer present. And since the court decided that CPS was basically acting as an agent of the police, well, that was a violation of her right to counsel.
And the court had some strong words to say about the right to counsel, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Justice Mercure wrote the opinion for the court, and he emphasized how the right to counsel is inviolable and fundamental to our entire justice system.
Huge.
It doesn't matter how serious the crime is,
yeah,
that right is there. The court basically said that, yes, CPS has to do interviews in child abuse investigations, but that requirement, it can't trump someone's constitutional rights, especially when CPS is working hand in hand with the police.
I see.
So the statements they got from the defendant, they were considered inadmissible, meaning they shouldn't have been allowed as evidence at the trial. This just shows how seriously courts take your Sixth Amendment rights once they've attached. They're not messing around.
No, they're not. But even if it was a mistake to allow those statements in, couldn't the prosecution say it was, you know, a harmless error, like it didn't really affect the outcome, so the conviction should still stand? What about that?
That's a great question. And the court addressed that whole harmless error idea head on. To say an error is harmless, an appeals court has to be sure there's no reasonable chance that that error contributed to the conviction.
Okay.
But in this case, the appellate division said, nope, can't say that here. They said those CPS statements, they directly and strongly went against the whole insanity defense the defendant was planning to use. Remember, the prosecution used those statements to suggest that she actually did have the mental state required for those crimes. So if those statements hadn't been allowed in, the jury might have seen her mental state very differently.
Interesting. So even though the statements were used to go against a specific defense, not as like direct proof of guilt, they were still powerful enough to maybe change the jury's verdict.
Exactly. The court made it super clear. Statements that are taken in violation of someone's right to counsel, they can't be used for any reason, not even to argue against an insanity defense.
Wow.
And because those statements could have swayed the jury's thinking about the defendant's mental state, there was a reasonable possibility that the error in letting their statements in, it affected the trial's outcome. So they couldn't just brush it off as harmless. They had to reverse the conviction.
Mm.
This case shows just how crucial it is to follow those constitutional safeguards all the way through the legal process.
It really does. This case has some major implications for how CPS and law enforcement work together in the future, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. People, V Anonymous is a big wake-up call. It's saying, hey, when CPS and law enforcement work closely together, especially after someone's right to a lawyer is kicked in, courts are going to be watching very closely.
Mm.
The decision basically says, look, these agencies, they often have the same goals, but they got to be careful not to cross the line. Like, one can't become the investigation arm of the other, especially if it steps on constitutional rights. This case reinforces the idea that procedural rights, they're not just technicalities, they're fundamental protections to make sure the legal process is fair. Agencies have to be mindful of how they interact, make sure they're not accidentally going around someone's constitutional rights.
So let's recap our deep dive into People v. Anonymous. We saw how the court really dug into the relationship between CPS and the police, used that four-factor test to figure out if there was an agency relationship. And because they found that relationship, the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel, it applied to her conversations with CPS after she was arraigned. And since those statements were taken without her lawyer there, boom, they should have been thrown out. And to top it off, the court said, letting those statements in wasn't just a little oopsie. It directly messed with her insanity defense, so it wasn't a harmless error.
Right. The case is a really clear example of how constitutional rights, that Sixth Amendment right to counsel, can come into play when different government agencies are working together. It shows how important the court's role is in making sure that even when the state is trying to do the right thing, they don't end up violating individual rights. And it emphasizes that when that right to counsel attaches, that timing is absolutely critical when deciding whether statements the state got are admissible.
This case, it really makes you think, doesn't it? You see those big legal ideas, agency, right to counsel, harmless error, all playing out in a real life situation.
Yeah.
With huge consequences.
Absolutely.
It's a solid reminder of why these protections exist and how they work in practice.
Couldn't agree more. And it makes you wonder about the future, you know? As agencies work together more and more, it's going to get more complicated. So how is that going to challenge those boundaries we've set up for individual rights? What can different parts of the government do to make sure those rights aren't accidentally trampled on while they're trying to do their jobs?
Yeah.
That's a big deal legally and for society as a whole. And it's probably going to lead to even more tough legal questions down the road.
Absolutely. Lots to think about. Well, thanks for diving deep with us today.
My pleasure.
Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.
See ya.